A frequent guest on Issues Etc., Aaron Wolf, died on Easter Sunday, April 21st, 2019. Learn how you can support Aaron's widow and his six children at issuesetc.org/AaronWolf. In his memory, we present this Issues Etc. encore. You know, you wouldn't think that you could go to social media and see images of crucifixions here in the 21st century, but there they are. Over the last several weeks, the images have been pouring out of northern Iraq. ISIS, this radical group that has established its own kind of independent government there, not just a government for Iraq, but they believe a government for all of the Islamic world, and hopefully they would hope for all of the world indeed. We have seen Christians persecuted and martyred all the way down to little children. We're going to talk about the plight of Christians in Iraq and find out how we got here and whether or not anyone could have seen this coming. Aaron Wolf joins us on this Monday afternoon, August the 11th. He's associate editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, and he's author of a recent column for Chronicles titled Iraqi Christians' Bloody Summer. Aaron, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Aaron, we were talking here about some, there's no other word for it, atrocities. ISIS is killing, crucifying, beheading, and otherwise terribly mistreating Iraqi Christians, targeting Iraqi Christians. Should we have seen this coming a decade or so ago when we began nation building in Iraq?
Yes, I'm afraid that is the case. We should have seen it coming, and some of us on the right did and wrote about it at the time. The reason we saw it coming, and as I say in the article, is because of a kind of a combination between a Christian perspective on human nature, which is we're all sinful, and that a sober reading of history. Because the Iraq that existed under Saddam Hussein was a hodgepodge of different Islamic groups. You know, I remember during the Bush years when there were jokes about whether the president knows the difference between Sunni and Shiite Muslims, and we had great fervor in this country to do something about the September 11th attacks. I remember that Alan Jackson song where he talked about I'm a regular guy, but I don't know the difference between Iraq and Iran. And we were all sort of as a country getting used to these different terms and learning about Islam. But for those who knew these different factions within Islam in the Middle East, in the Levant and around all the way to Iran, we knew that Iraq was something that was kind of a powder keg, and really the only thing keeping it together was this sort of dictator from the Ba'ath party named Saddam Hussein. Because even though Ba'ath is a Sunni party, they're very secularist. They don't seek to impose Sharia everywhere. And so they were able to sort of hold together loosely this coalition of Sunni, Shiites, Kurds, and a few different flavors of Christianity within this thing on the map that we called Iraq. And so when Saddam was ousted, of course, we had a provisional government there, but immediately the majority, about 60-65% of Shiite Muslims in Iraq, wanted one of their own leaders in there. And of course, the neighboring Shiite Iran did as well. And from the get-go, as soon as we began to pull out our coalition government there, the Shiites began to enter the picture, and this caused great strife among the current citizens of Iraq, the Sunni in particular, because this is a battle that's been going on with them for centuries. And the Kurds have also been a group that's for years felt like they have been ousted or left out of the government representation by the Ba'ath Party. They wanted their own independent state, and now we have Kurdish authorities. The president is Kurdish of Iraq, and the one who is the Shiite who is being ousted even now is Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who's been very friendly with U.S. officials, is also a Shiite. And so along comes this string of Arab springs around Africa and the Middle East, and Sunni Islamist groups begin to coalesce, particularly in Syria, and the rest is recent history with this group that's now calling itself, it was ISIS or ISIL, and now they're simply going by the name Islamic State, and they've declared themselves to be a caliphate, meaning that they believe themselves to be a completely autonomous Islamic nation state with basically a dictatorial caliph at the top.
So to kind of put it in a nutshell, and it's obviously in terms of the politics, the foreign relations, the military aspects of this, extremely complex. We had a more or less secular Islamic State in Iraq. We toppled that, attempted to set up a more or less secular Islamic State in Iraq, and at this point seem to have failed miserably.
Yes, I mean, it's a funny thing about democracy. When you allow people to vote, then the will of the people, at least the majority, tends to come through. And one of the things I said in that article is that I think as Americans, we have a difficult time imagining how people in what we consider third world countries take their religion seriously. You know, we see it as this sort of abstraction in our lives so often as Americans, where we go to church on Sunday and we have our politics over here in this other compartment. But it turns out the rest of the world doesn't always think that way. And when it comes to Muslims of these various stripes in war-torn places like Iraq, they were eager to put someone in power who reflected the majority's sentiments, particularly about Islam and about the which holy books they subscribe to and what version of Sharia law that they wish to install. And this is something that if you're a student of history, which when we used to have diplomats in this country, and instead of those who suffered from a sort of liberal education in the modern sense, then we understood those things better, and we knew not to mess around like this. But we have been in a process of nation building, and particularly now in the Middle East. But it's just the simple facts of what happened that this group of ideologues that we call the neoconservatives, they formed this thing called the Project for the New American Century back in the late 90s under the Clinton administration. These neoconservative thinkers got together and they decided that they wanted for the coming 21st century to have their principles outlined. And one of the main things that they wished to see, and which they published repeatedly in years leading up to the September 11th tragedy and horror, was a call first for Clinton and then for George W. Bush to effect regime change in Iraq. And this fits with neoconservative principles.
Speaking of neoconservatives, you respond early in your piece in Chronicles to Jonah Goldberg. You say, armchair Terminator Jonah Goldberg is blasting President Obama, for his wild inconsistency when it comes to military intervention, suggesting that Americans should surgically rain down hell upon ISIS. Now, I know that that kind of feeds into or feeds upon our gut reaction to the mistreatment of Christians and others under ISIS. Yeah. But why is that a bad idea?
Well, we've tried it before, and it doesn't work. I mean, if we could, it took us quite a while to find Osama bin Laden, despite many of these failed surgical bombs. And of course, I'm kind of playing on words there because it's very difficult surgically to drop those sorts of bombs. And we know that a lot of times, whether our boots on the ground just give us the wrong intelligence, or if we just simply are too late or too early, that we miss our intended target, but we either way wind up killing somebody, and oftentimes more than one somebody. And what happens when we do these bombing campaigns is we inflame the passions of Muslims, of the folks whose hearts and minds we would hope to change and win over to our side, so that they might at least have mercy. Maybe not ISIS, because I don't know. I said in the article, frankly, I don't know what we do with them short of a full-scale boots-on-the-ground invasion and mass executions, because we have folks here who have committed such horrendous crimes against these Chaldean Christians that it really pains us to even to describe the pictures that are coming out on the internet. But when we talk about bombing these folks, we really cannot affect the change that we wish to. And as I said before, we've tried it, and it just doesn't work. Instead, what it does is it galvanizes, and it causes more people holding up dead children and the like in the streets to rally around these radical Islamic groups who associate, and I think rather falsely, given our recent record in this country, everything Western and American particularly with Christianity. And so as we drop bombs, as the West or as the United States drops bombs, even if we hit some of our intended targets, we cement this idea that these dear Christian people who are literally facing martyrdom in Mosul and in that area, the province of Nineveh in northern Iraq, that we're reinforcing this notion that these people are somehow outlanders who are connected to the United States and need to be purged so that they can have this pure Islamic state.
Aaron Wolf is our guest on this Monday afternoon, August the 11th. We're talking about the plight of Iraqi Christians and how we arrived at it. He's author of a recent column for Chronicles magazine titled Iraqi Christians' Bloody Summer. We'll be right back.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/LCMSU.
Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria in the 4th century, was known for boldly confessing Jesus Christ as both true God and true man. This is what we do at St. Athanasius Lutheran Church in Vienna, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C., continuing this historic confession of our Savior who died for us and now comes to us in word and sacrament. If you live in the D.C. area or just visiting, come join us. For more information, find us on the web, St. Athanasius Lutheran Church.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This generation has told all the previous generations to shut up, to keep silent.
Pastor Will Whedon, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
Instead of the church's classical way of operating, supplementation, we've replaced the heritage of proclamation and song that reaches back to the earliest centuries with only the song of now.
You can listen to Pastor Whedon's presentation, Making the Case for Classical Christian Hymnody, and all of the teachings from the 2014 Making the Case Conference on a new audio DVD for a $300 donation to Issues Etc. before Labor Day. We'll send you this audio DVD. For more information, look for the DVD logo at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the plight of Iraqi Christians. Aaron Wolf is our guest, associate editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. Before the break, Aaron, we were talking about the neoconservative miscalculation here that seems to continue. I'm wondering what you think about Jonah Goldberg, who has recently suggested that it was the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq that has brought about the carnage that we are witnessing there today. What's your reaction?
Well, I mean, on the surface, I say, yes, it's true. But the question that arises is, was that not inevitable eventually? We simply don't have the resources or the will to stay in such a place forever. That's the kind of thought process that needs to occur before we make these decisions to, quote, nation build. Because it's really a contradiction in terms. You can't just come in from the outside and build a nation, a native people. You can import one. I mean, in the United States in the past, and certainly the British Empire before, has colonized places and brought the folks over who have their own beliefs and are sympathetic toward the sort of government that's being imported as well. But in terms of taking that, an ideology, an abstract philosophy of how people ought to live their lives, and this American notion that we're born sort of tabula rasa, we're a blank slate, and we get to make all of these choices to determine who and what we are and what we believe, and so that, you know, a child need not reflect at all what his father or mother believe or have done. This is foreign to so much of the world. And so the idea that we come in, or anybody comes in, and builds a nation, to I think most of the world is absurdity. And the proof is really in the last few years, what we've seen both in Iraq and in Libya and even it with Syria. In fact, what winds up happening is that in our effort to identify a sympathetic group that's against the current regime that we wish to topple, and this is what happened with Assad in Syria, is we wind up funneling money to groups that are connected to Al-Qaeda, and particularly helping to fund the start of this group that calls itself ISIS or the Islamic State.
So what lessons should we have learned by now after an Arab Spring turned into several Arab Springs in Iraq, Syria, Egypt, you name it, the entire Middle East? What lessons should we have learned by now about trying to mix Islam with democracy?
Well, the fundamentally, from the point of view of what the Quran teaches and all of its permutations, Sunni and Shiite Islam, there is a conflict with the notion of a people of an Islamic people living truly according to their beliefs as an Islamic nation and participating in what we in the West think of as democracy. I mean, certainly folks voted even in the Soviet Union on things, but the meaning and significance of that is very different in those parts of the world. And then we ought to learn, I think, that Islam is very serious as a threat to Christianity when it is allowed, like a wine, to be uncorked and breathe. And what we experience in the United States, for the most part, are very westernized Muslims who choose to be here and who wish to participate in our way of life. However, as we've seen even with some of these terrorist recruits that were grown up here, that came over from areas of the Middle East that participated in September 11th, that these folks tend to have triggers in their lives, or even, you know, the Boston Marathon bomber as well, that when hard times come, Muslims tend to, just by the record, tend to become more what we call fundamentalist. I hate even using that term, because when we say it, we typically mean that as an aberration from regular Islam, the so-called religion of peace. It's simply not the case in the history of the world. And what we're witnessing now with this extreme violence in Mosul and in northern Iraq and western Iraq, and really pushing and bearing down on Baghdad, is Islam uncorked.
So let's talk a little bit about, we talked about Jonah Goldberg, but who are some other names among the neocons, and what have been their various reactions to what's been happening in Iraq in the last several weeks and months?
Sure. Well, some of them from particularly the Bush years, were Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, his Undersecretary Paul Wolfowitz, another Undersecretary Elliot Abrams. The two founders of the Project for the New American Century were Robert Kagan and William Kristol. William Kristol's the son of Irving Kristol, who was essentially the intellectual founder of neoconservatism, a former Trotskyite who came to this country with the understanding that that in order for you to have a great nation at home, you have to go about with force. And the founding document of the Project for the New American Century talks about, you know, spreading our values, our morality around the world. These neoconservatives gained a pretty strong foothold in the Reagan administration, and they've kind of always been around. I think probably Bill Kristol is the most well-known, because he's on so many of the Sunday talk shows, and even recently now he looks at these political events in the Middle East, and he turns it, as Goldberg did in that article, and as many of the other neoconservatives are doing today, into kind of a bat with which to beat President Obama. And so, you know, as long as the Republicans continue to sort of see their default foreign policy as what the neoconservatives say, and this need to project power with our thousands of military bases around the globe, and to sort of promote what they call our interests by encouraging what they call democracy in these countries. And that's, of course, why they targeted Iraq, because Saddam Hussein was a power. I mean, he had his own oil, and he was well-financed, and he had a fairly strong government. And they believe, the neoconservatives, they plainly outlined this in the late 90s and early 2000s, that they saw Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime as a threat to spreading our values and our way of life in the Middle East. It's the same attitude that led up to the battle with this Syria crisis that's been going on now for close to 3 years, and of course Assad is also a Ba'athist and a very similar approach. And so, yes, we find that he did this or that atrocity he was involved with, well, as Saddam Hussein was accused of gassing the Kurds. And certainly there's no need to downplay that these are bad, bad things. But sometimes the devil you know is worse than the one you don't. And when you find the United States in opposition to Assad funneling money to groups that, whoops, it turns out they're even more extreme and they're associated with Al-Qaeda, and then Al-Qaeda thinks that even these people are too extreme and oust them, and they form ISIS, the Islamic State, we realize that there's more involved here than just politics. There's religion involved. And something that the neoconservatives typically don't take seriously enough. They see things very much in terms of economics and military might, and they leave religious beliefs sort of in the background. And so you had this past weekend more calls from Bill Kristol and other neocons on these talk shows, saying that, you know, saying that President Obama hasn't acted soon enough and he needs to, we support the bombing and we need more bombing.
Aaron Wolf is our guest. We're talking about the plight of Iraqi Christians on this Monday, August the 11th. He is author of a recent column for Chronicles Magazine, a magazine of American culture, titled Iraqi Christians' Bloody Summer. You can read it on the Listen Out On Demand page at our website, issuesetc.org. When we come back, why is it that even at this late date, neoconservatives fail to take into account Islam as a religion and a worldview? We'll be right back.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. I teach an adult Bible class every week at the church where I serve, and I wonder about the nature of the questions. After about 25 years in the ministry, you've probably asked every question about the Bible. I don't know the answers to all those questions. I can do a good job of taking a Bible passage apart and putting it back together, but a lot of the detailed questions, the kind of questions that a pastor gets asked in Bible class, the kind of question you might want to ask your pastor when you're studying your Bible individually, but you don't want to bother him with it, you can find the answers to those questions in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August. It's the Lutheran Bible Companion. It's two volume, an introduction and the Old Testament, then also the intertestamental era, the New Testament, and a Bible dictionary, all in two volumes of the Lutheran Bible Companion. You can find out more about this great resource from Concordia Publishing House by going to our website, issuesetc.org, or order Lutheran Bible Companion in two volumes from Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August. We're talking about the plight of Iraqi Christians on this Monday afternoon, August the 11th. Aaron Wolf is our guest, Associate Editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, author of a recent column for Chronicles titled Iraqi Christians' Bloody Summer. You were mentioned before the break, Aaron, that neoconservatives do tend to look in the world in kind of political, generically political, economic lenses. They look at the world through those lenses. I have a hard time understanding how it is that even at this late date, neoconservatives fail to take into account Islam as a religion and therefore as an all-encompassing worldview. What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think because they take their own religion sort of in this more as a sense of ethnic identity and in terms of a belief in the God of the supernatural or however they describe it. Many of the neocons, certainly not all of them, as Don Rumsfeld was a prototypical example, are Jewish, but they're very much in line with Likud in Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu. They are sort of semi-secularist Jews. They're not looking to throw rocks at BMWs driving around Jerusalem or Tel Aviv on the Sabbath. They see religion more in terms of an ethnic identity. And so therefore, when they sort of project, as most people do, themselves onto others, they see the Muslims of the Middle East of their various stripes as people who could be motivated if only they had opportunities for economic freedom and more choices in terms, you know, the women of their lives. If only these women could be offered a society in which they didn't have to wear the veil, well, they would all be grateful and they would love that. And we see, of course, the exact opposite. The United States, our liberal media tends to promote, you know, the exceptions of a Muslim woman who turns feminist and throws off the veil and advocates against violence inherent in the patriarchal Muslim household. But that's certainly the exception to the rule. These people believe very seriously in their religion, including their Quran, which tells them plainly that those who believe, whether the Jews or the Christians, those who believe that the Christ was, as they put it, the son of Allah, that may Allah destroy them. And that's the very context in which they call for the jizya, the tax that in Arabic that is put on in Islamic states or government-controlled Islamic areas on the minority religions whom they allow to stay. Now, that's something we haven't heard as much about in recent years until ISIS came in and began levying this jizya in the northern Iraq, wherever they were seizing power. And when they did, and this is just the, you know, so barbaric and horrible, these folks were Christians, Chaldean Christians, were willing to pay it in order to be allowed to live there. But then the ISIS members have turned around and just used that willingness as an identifying marker for Christians. And in some cases, they have demanded in Mosul that anyone who paid this tax offer up one or all of his daughters, even his wife, as wives of Muslims. And in other cases, they have simply brutally murdered the entire family to the extent that even children have been targeted by members of ISIS or the Islamic State as they roll through Mosul. And this shocking story that was emerging, although really the stories have been there in European and Middle Eastern media for several weeks, but it kind of came out in an interview on CNN late last week where even children in Mosul were being beheaded and their heads put on display in a public park in Mosul. Now, again, this is shocking and horrific, and I don't encourage anybody to go out looking for these pictures, but it is happening, and it's a result of, ultimately, of a very failed policy in the Middle East.
Okay, so a couple final questions for you. You say that for their part, American Christians need to sober up from what you say is the long night at the bar with the neoconservatives. What are you talking about specifically?
Well, I think that that Americans have tended to, American Christians, and you know, I used to say evangelicals, but really, broadly speaking, this affects Catholics, it affects Lutherans to some extent. Really, every conservative Christianity in the United States tends toward a view of Israel as a holding a special place within God's plan for history. And this is, we've talked many times over the years about the influence of dispensationalism, but it goes even beyond that to just a general feeling of our allies in the Middle East. Now, why bring up Israel? Because the neoconservatives are typically very pro-Israel and are very vocal about it, and it's very easy to cast those who are skeptical about Israel, the Israelis' policy toward, say, Gaza, or their stance toward Iraq or Syria, that anybody questions the Likud line, that immediately the neoconservatives start saying you're an anti-Semite and you're a liberal, because we know that the mainline denominations who believe virtually nothing anymore in the United States are also tend to support Palestinians. So conservative American Christians are naturally, I think, drawn toward a neoconservative view of the Middle East in general because of their almost knee-jerk support for Israel. And by buying into that, and by buying into the idea that we can somehow, as a foreign and very powerful military, affect the outcome of these centuries, even millennia-old battles between Jews and Muslims, between Muslims and other Muslims and Kurds, is foolhardy. And so I think that we might seek a more traditional, as conservatives especially, approach toward foreign policy, which doesn't seek, like the neocons tend to do, interventions everywhere and all the time. I think that this is a good time not to follow their line, but unfortunately, you know, if Facebook shares and conversations I've had with folks that I know are any indication, it's precisely in moments like this where we see something that every Christian just feels, you know, it tenses up your insides, and you want to do something to stop this slaughter of believers, fellow Christians in Mosul in northern Iraq. It's times like this where we typically get drawn in to a foreign policy approach that is exactly the cause, or at least one of the causes, for the situation we now faced. More bombs selectively dropped on what our intelligence tells us is this or that leader are not going to change the fundamental cast of the Middle East and of Iraq.
With about a minute, when we were building up for the Iraqi war, we did hours of open lines with our listeners back then. And we were asking them many questions, but probably the bottom line question we were asking them was, would a war in Iraq be a just war? And I remember several listeners stating that it would be a just war since it would allow for the preaching of the gospel in Iraq eventually. What did those listeners fail to understand?
I think they failed to understand a separation of the two kingdoms. I mean, the kingdom of the left hand, what we Lutherans refer to as the civil government and the powers that be that are ordained of God, as Paul put it, have particular responsibilities and callings, and preaching the gospel is not one of them. And whereas when we talk about the church and the kingdom of the right hand, well, yes, that is what God has called us to do. When it comes to civil government, I think that we have to step back and say, following what we traditionally call just war theory, What is it that we are defending, and what gives us the right, from a Christian perspective, to use deadly force? I think that we, many of us, just missed that point when it came to Iraq, and we have in other places, because we've been enraptured by philosophies that don't really come from Scripture.
Before we let you go, tell us, with about 30 seconds, tell us about Chronicles, a magazine of American culture.
We are the antidote to neoconservatism. We are at chroniclesmagazine.org. If you get a subscription, which you can do online now, you can see our archives. I think we go back as far now as 2008, but we're constantly adding more. Where our hope is to have our entire, all the way back to 1977, online for subscribers. And you can see there where we try to talk plainly about the history and about what's going on with the leaders who are in play in places like this. We talk about a lot more than foreign policy, but that is one thing that going all the way back to the Iraq War, where we tried to take a close look at what would happen if we invaded. And I think that we were pretty accurate.
Folks, you can find out more about Chronicles Magazine at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Aaron Wolf is Associate Editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, and author of a recent column for Chronicles titled Iraqi Christians' Bloody Summer. Aaron, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
When we come back on this Monday afternoon, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Tom Baker, host of a radio show called Law and Gospel. We're going to be doing our regular Sunday school lesson with him. The few verses we find there in Acts chapter 16 that mentions Lydia, the seller of purple. She is a Gentile, but she is also called a God-fearer or a God-worshipper. What does that mean? And she ends up baptized, not only her, but her whole household as well. That holds some strong parallels with some of these other accounts in the book of Acts that we'll talk about with Pastor Tom Baker on the other side of the grade. It is our Sunday school lesson with Pastor Baker. We'll be in Acts chapter 16, beginning at verse 11, Lydia and the baptism of her household. Stay tuned.
You know that when your eyes close here, that when they open there, the first face you'll see, like the blind man, is Jesus's.
Pastor Chris Roseborough, host of Fighting for the Faith, speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
This is the gospel. It's Jesus. And when you take these texts and make them about you, you miss him. And you leave yourself with no hope. And our hope is in him.
You can listen to Chris's entire presentation and teachings by Craig Parton, Matt Harrison, Al Schmidt, Will Whedon, and Jonathan Fisk on a new audio DVD for the 2014 Making the Case Conference. We'll send it to you for a donation of $300 to Issues Etc. before Labor Day. For more information, look for the DVD logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
It's here. It's here. It's finally here. Lutheran Catechesis Catechist Edition. A comprehensive guide to catechesis for a Lutheran congregation, including expanded helps on the catechism, a section of catechesis on the table of duties, Christian vocation, and learn-by-heart schedules for the congregation at prayer. Order yours today from the Concordia Catechetical Academy at peacesussex.org.